Welcome back to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone, and today's episode, The Harmony of the Heavens, is exploring the inspiring connections between the universe, mathematics, and music. In part one, we talked about the similarities in the mathematical composition of the universe and the mathematical composition of musical harmony. We talked about how this concept has been discussed and explored throughout history by mathematicians, authors, and musicians, and how it is even implied in several biblical passages, which shows the earliest origins of this idea. These mathematical similarities between the universe and music greatly impact the way instruments are tuned. Various methods of tuning instruments have greatly impacted the music that has been written for these instruments. To help explain this further, let's talk to a piano tuner. He's more properly a piano technician. He works on the Steinway pianos here at Armstrong Auditorium, and he prepares all the pianos for the high-end concert series throughout the Midwest region. So for our backstage banter segment today, where we interview performers on the concert circuit for their perspectives on music, we talk to Peter Kraus.
For a technician whose ambition was to become one of the Steinway basement guys, one of the concert technicians, except not live there, live in Oklahoma. I want to be the Steinway solution in the middle of the country. It's like a dream come true. This is what's happened. Almost all of the big players that come through here, I get to take care of. It's like a candy factory. I mean, you know, I learn something from every one of these characters. That's the post-grad school in this business, is working for people who play that well. At any given time, there's a mountaintop, and there are maybe six or seven people sitting around the very top of the mountain with their backs to each other, and those are the best working pianists working at that time. And I get to work for those people. I can't believe it sometimes. I'm so grateful that in this time of my life, when I'm 69 years old, this is creatively, artistically, this is the most exciting time of my life for me, right now.
And you've had a pretty, you know, decorated past as a performer, as a jazz pianist. Can you talk about your work as a jazz pianist?
Sure. I was the first call jazz pianist around here, around this city, the Metroplex, and beyond, for about 30 years. I worked for just whoever came through playing a concert I got to play with. Doc Severinsen, Buddy DeFranco, great clarinet player. Pete Chrisleib, the lead tenor saxophone player on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show band. Played a show with Phyllis Diller one time, who was a real eye-opener. She was sweet, quiet, educated, totally different from the hag that she plays in her Phyllis Diller routine. I loved her. Everybody in the band loved her. She was really a revelation. And she specifically requested a jazz trio to be the play-on, play-off band and the backup band on a couple of tunes that she wanted to do. She was absolutely a delight to work with.
And so let's talk more about the actual process of tuning a piano. You're there with your ears and a couple of tools. Mm-hmm. Talk about the difference between the old school type of tuning and the modern digital.
Gladly, because this is one of my favorite topics. I have a basic tuning kit and a tuning fork. So basically what I do is I do it in a way that was taught to me by some old timers. You start with a tuning fork and you establish one pitch. And then you establish usually an octave of that pitch, usually the octave below. And now you have a bracket. Determining the size of the octave is one step that where a lot of argument happens. But again, among the community of the best technicians, there is a recognized way to do that. Then you establish other intervals inside the octave. There's an interval relationship within that octave between fourths and fifths that's considered the best way to do it. There's an interval relationship that makes sixths to get a little bit faster as they go up and slower as they go down. There's an interval relationship that makes thirds within that octave that's just considered the best, the state-of-the-art way to do it. I do that, and then I tune the rest of the piano. Again, the way that Steinway mastermind has learned is the way to do it that works the best way most of the time. there's a way to do it that makes it as beautiful as it is in the nature of the particular piano to be. And it's been done the same way for a long, long, long time. We don't really need electronic tuning devices to help us do this because the piano is already giving us way more information than we need to do a really good tuning. My feeling about the ETD is this. ETDs, that's electronic tuning devices, it measures one frequency at a time. That's what it does.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't listen to relationships between
right.
notes.
Right.
It doesn't listen to sonority. It doesn't listen to whether an interval, thus measured and set, is beautiful or not. It can't listen and make judgments about, well, the numbers say that this interval is supposed to be here, but if I move this note a couple of hundredths of a cent in this direction, suddenly that interval sings. It's like a human voice. It sounds beautiful. So where is a tuner with an artistic sensibility going to leave that interval? He's going to leave it where it's beautiful. If you tune an octave, or in any interval, or just a unison, three strings by itself, and you get it to the point where you don't have any beats, so let's say it's
right,
we're just talking about
those discrepancies in the frequencies.
The little waves that happen when the strings are not tuned to the exact same frequency.
Right.
Okay, you tune the unison so that it's more or less beatless. There will be in that unison a sweet spot that is the most centered, most perfect, most beautiful sound that that piano is capable of making on that note at that time with those hammers in place. It's a different sound from almost there. So what our objective in the concert business is to do when we're working for somebody like Menahem Pressler, for instance, I was trying to find the sweet spot in every octave and every interval on that piano so that that piano would sing like it was a living thing. And I got it to do that, and he heard it. And he enjoyed that piano so much for that reason. That's the level that we aspire to try to make the piano, to not just get the piano accurately tuned, which is kind of debatable anyway. I mean, the whole thing's out of tune with itself to begin with. It's all compromises. Accurately tuned to what? It's all over the place.
Right.
When you find that sweet spot, the tonal character of the sound changes into something else. It changes into something transcendent. It makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck when I find it. At that point, the piano technician becomes a co-performer, even though the audience never sees me. It feels like a performance in every way except that I'm not actually physically walking out on the stage. It's so much fun, it just ought to be illegal.
You use that word compromise, and I know we say, well, the piano is never really in tune in a pure traditional, like classic sense of math. And that's why you say you have to use the ear and not the electronic tuners and that type of thing. And you even use terms like stretch octave, when an octave we know is a 2-to-1 frequency, but obviously you're going a little beyond that because of the range of the instrument? I mean, just talk a little bit about those compromises, I guess what we would call temperament.
Okay.
Is that
yeah.
right?
Yeah, temperament is simply a way to arrange the notes inside the octave so that they work the best way they can work in all the keys with all the chords. There's a lot of different ways to do that, but the equal temperament is the best one that we've found that works best for everything. Some technicians that I know have practices at universities where the pianists play a lot of ancient music. Nobody actually, after all of the study that's gone into it, nobody actually knows what temperament Bach used. Every 5 or 10 years, there's a big fight where somebody comes up with new research and shoots down everything that's gone before. So at this point, you know, it's all over the place like at the end of a battle. We don't have any idea what Bach used. The business about the stretched octaves is interesting. A440, let's say, the A above middle C, right? 440 cycles a second. Theoretically, the A an octave above that is supposed to be 880, right? If you tune that, it will sound more or less pure, beatless, but it will sound flat. The top note will sound flat to the ear, even within the context of one octave. If you tune successive octaves of A all the way to the top of the piano, doubling the frequency each time, by the time you get to the top of the piano with an arpeggio, the top A that you play at the top of the piano will start to sound a quarter of a step flat. It will sound so flat that people who don't have any musical sensibility will turn around and look at it funny and go, that sounds flat on top, you know. The ear wants the treble, the high treble, to be higher than the math says it should be, and it wants the low notes to be a little bit lower than the math says that it should be. We're trying to tune. This gets back to the tuning mastermind that's come through all of these generations of experience with concerts. This worked, that didn't work. What we found is that there's a way to stretch octaves that pleases pianists more than octaves that are not stretched.
So there's the objective element, the mathematical element of, well, you know, these are the basic numbers involved. But then you have the human element of our ears tend to round things off. You know, we don't hear the exact mathematical decimal point.
That's right.
And so you're mixing the objective mathematical with the human artistic, because it's the ear that's going to hear it.
And also there's another variable that's very interesting. It's not only the tendency of the ear to round things off in certain directions. It's also, what are the notes going to sound like in the particular piece that the artist is playing? In Mozart, I don't stretch very much at all, or in Beethoven, when there's an orchestra. If you look at the piano parts, there'll be a solo, single-note piano part up here, or an octave, or whatever. And in good operatic tradition, almost always there's some instrument in the orchestra that's playing that note an octave or two below where the piano has it. It's in there. If I stretch the piano too much in a piece like that, the pitch Nazis in the orchestra, who are the reed players, are going to hold that down, even if the trumpet players are trying like crazy to stretch the octaves and play higher and higher and higher. The people who consider it their job to keep the pitch down are going to grit their teeth and look right at the pianist like this and play it right where they think it is, even if it's obviously a different pitch from what's in on the piano. In a concerto like that, I don't stretch the octaves very much in the piano part. In a Russian concerto where the orchestra is swirling all over the place and the pianist is playing arpeggios up and down the piano, it doesn't matter. If you stretch a lot more in a piece like that, it actually sounds better.
How you temper a piano is based on the artist, the piece, the grouping with other instruments?
Subtly, yes. It's not a big difference. What I'm trying to do is to make it as smooth as I can. I'm trying to get the best sound out of it that I can possibly get the piano to make. And I'm trying to get the piano to be the... When you go to Walmart, you can buy like the 50 box of crayons or the 400 box of crayons. What we want the piano to be is the biggest box of crayons that we can give the pianist to use. For that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for talking with me. This has been
my pleasure.
Really enlightening.
Thanks for asking me.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. We've been talking about the connections between the harmony of the universe and musical harmony, referred to as the harmony of the spheres or the music of the spheres, or as this episode is titled, the harmony of the heavens. We have seen it discussed throughout human history, even being referenced early on in the biblical record. Now, to this point, I have mostly been playing certain examples of pieces that either reference this concept in their lyrics, or whose composers were consciously aware of this cosmic element and used that understanding in writing their music, working off that understanding. At the beginning of the 20th century, a composer was creating an epic orchestral work that is based on some of these ideas. We already heard some of this work at the very beginning of this episode, Jupiter. This is from a piece by Gustav Holst called The Planets. This piece was composed between 1914 and 1916. It has seven movements. There's no movement for Earth, and there's no movement for Pluto. This is an example of programmatic music. Programmatic music is descriptive music, or music that is written to describe something of a non-musical nature. That's programmatic music. We'll have a whole episode just on this idea. Now, this particular piece is not intended to provide music that sounds like the planet looks. It has to do more with these literary, mythological connections. Mars was the bringer of war, and so that movement sounds very militaristic and very warlike. Jupiter, the bringer of jollity, its music sounds very joyful. David Wright said, Holst was drawn to the association of each planet with a part of human life. So even though each of these relate to some mythological description of the planets, the characteristics are relatable by everyone to some element of everyday life. And still yet, I want to step away from these literary descriptions of each planet and talk about the music itself. These pieces incorporate some great compositional techniques. First, an overview of these seven movements. Holst puts Mars first in this seven-movement work. Then comes Venus, the bringer of peace. Mercury is the winged messenger. Then comes Jupiter, bringer of jollity. Then Saturn, the bringer of old age. Then Uranus, the magician. And the last movement, Neptune, the mystic, incorporates a children's chorus, giving the piece a truly outer space feel. Time magazine's music critic Michael Walsh wrote about the planets in his book, Who's Afraid of Classical Music? He called it one of music's great leaps of imagination, so what if Holst never wrote another piece like it? Nobody else did either. That's what Michael Walsh said. Now, there are really two cool things in Mars that I want to point out to you. First of all, there's this three-note motive, this three-note melody that gets repeated over and over, a very simple melody. A very ominous sounding melody. And the second thing is, there's what we call an ostinato in this piece. An ostinato is a recurring musical pattern that happens over and over, usually underpinning an entire section of a piece of music, or maybe an entire movement, or an entire piece. This movement is in 5/4 time. That means each measure gets 5 beats. The stress pattern for the beats happen in 5 beat patterns. And this is an unusual meter signature or time signature. Usually music gets 4 beats to the measure or 2 beats to the measure, or maybe 3 beats to the measure or 6 beats to the measure, something divisible by 2. But this piece is in 5/4 time and there's an ostinato. And the ostinato is this rhythm. Da 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 da. And that rhythm, 1 and a 2, 3, 4, and 5, happens over and over throughout this movement. Listen to a little bit of Mars and listen for this three-note motive, this three-note melody, and this ostinato in 5/4 time. This is Leonard Slatkin conducting the Philharmonia Orchestra. Each year at Herbert W. Armstrong College, I require knowing this movement in my music appreciation class, Mars from the Planets by Gustav Holst. And I always tell my students that that ending of that movement reminds me so much of a part in the Star Wars soundtrack where John Williams writes for the moment where the Death Star is about to explode. Next, we'll talk about Venus, the bringer of peace, in Holst's seven-movement work, The Planets. This movement starts with those ascending four notes in the horn, and it favors instruments in the higher registers, and also the music is very serene and sustained. And this is to represent the idea of peace, in contrast to the previous movement, that of war. Let's listen to a little bit more of this. The next movement in The Planets is Mercury, the Winged Messenger. This is the fastest movement, and it's the shortest, which makes sense because of the descriptive element in the title. Arguably the most popular movement, though, in Holst's The Planets is Jupiter, the bringer of jollity. This is how we opened this particular episode. Gustav Holst was an English composer, and he often looked to English folk music for inspiration for his compositions. The slow middle section of Jupiter, though this melody sounds like an English folk tune, actually was a folk-like tune that Holst wrote and then it became a patriotic British song called I Vow to Thee My Country. So we were just listening to Jupiter by Gustav Holst from his seven-movement orchestral suite, The Planets. And though these are referencing certain literary elements of the planets, as appears in mythology, there certainly are so many great things that we can look at in just the music itself, in how he puts these things together and how he describes these different elements, really, as we read in an earlier quote, of humanity, of human life. And that was an example of jollity. The next movement in The Planets is Saturn, the bringer of old age. So this is what old age sounds like in music. So this is here representing various facets of old age, the elderly voice of wisdom and acceptance with growing older and serenity with it. And that's all being portrayed in this movement, Saturn. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. We are discussing today these inspiring connections between the universe and music. And here we have a piece of music inspired by The Planets. This is Gustav Holst's orchestral suite in seven movements titled The Planets. The next planet is Uranus the Magician. I think when you hear this movement, you can think more of a comical entertainer type of magician, if you'd like, very vaudeville-like with dramatic flair. The final movement, Neptune, is just full of sustained, soft sounds. Holst scores this to include a treble chorus, sometimes performed by women, sometimes performed by children, to add to the color of the orchestra for this movement. He also makes extensive use of the harp and a tinkling-sounding keyboard instrument called a celesta. We have been listening to this recording of Leonard Slatkin conducting the Philharmonia Orchestra performing Gustav Holst's seven-movement orchestral suite, The Planets. That final movement, Neptune the Mystic, included a children's chorus. That leads us into our final segment for today's show, Classroom Corner, where we explore different methods and curricula for introducing young people to music. Today, for this segment, we will explore the connections between math and music and how math is used to teach musical concepts to young people. We will also speak with Dr. David Kung of St. Mary's College in Maryland about his course that was released as one of the great courses, a DVD series, on how mathematics and music relate. Young music students, whether they realize it or not, are learning a lot about math when they learn about music. This is most evident when they learn about rhythm. Pitches without rhythm is like liquid without a container, or like flesh and muscles without bones. Rhythm, I tell my students, is the schedule for the notes. It is a measurement for the duration of each pitch, just like we talk in terms of something taking 30 minutes, or that we will be somewhere in 1 hour, or that a particular course will take 4 months. We are using measurements of time. Music students have to learn the musical representations of time measurement, most simply in terms of note values, and they also have to learn the groupings of these durations. That is, they learn patterns known as time signatures or meter signatures. Pitches can be held a variety of durations, from the smallest fraction of a beat, all the way to 4, 6, or 8 beats, or even longer. How long is a beat? Well, that's a pretty arbitrary measurement. It's like saying, how much is a dollar worth in global terms? In rhythm, the length of the beat has a lot to do with the speed or tempo the composer dictates. But what is not arbitrary is the numeric relationship between note values. For instance, if a whole note gets 4 beats, or 2 beats, or 8 beats, it will still always take 4 quarter notes to equal 1 whole note, since a quarter note is 1/4 the value of a whole note. Just like 4 U.S. quarters are always going to equal $1 bill, no matter what the currency conversion is. So, in spite of the arbitrary nature of the speed of the beat, or even how many beats a note gets, the relationship of these note values remains the same. 2 half notes are always equal to 1 whole note. 2 quarter notes always equal a half note. 2 eighth notes always equal a quarter note, and so on. What this is an extremely mathematical concept that students have to learn in order to perform music well. Even while learning these basic rudiments of rhythm, these lengths of sound, the students are also learning to put them into recurring patterns of stress. We later call this time signature or meter signature. We teach students that if a strong beat occurs every 2 beats, then we have 2 beats per pattern, or 2 beats per bar, that vertical line in music that separates these rhythmic groupings or these rhythmic patterns. If the strong beat occurs every 3 beats, like in a waltz, the music has 3 beats per bar. If the strong beat occurs every 4 beats, then it's 4 beats a bar, and so on. A set of numbers at the beginning of the score will tell the performer how many beats occur in each grouping or each bar, and then another number tells the performer which note is assigned the beat. This time signature, for those of you who've seen any piece of music, looks appropriately enough like a fraction. But these are really just the most basic connections between math and music. There are so many others that can help the music student learn. And for that, I want to talk about a course I recently watched. It was one of the Great Courses DVD series that our college library here at Herbert W. Armstrong College purchased. And it was taught by Dr. David Kung of St. Mary's College in Maryland. I asked him if he would share some of the content and some of the research from that course with us today.
When I was 4 years old, my mother wanted to start my brother and I on musical instruments. And my older brother chose piano, and the other instrument that they were teaching at the time was violin. And so I started playing violin at age 4. And I was pretty serious about it for a long time. In high school, I went to Interlochen Music Camp, you know, one of the big music camps. This one's up in Michigan. I think when I was at Interlochen, I realized that there were people who were perfectly happy to play their instruments for 7 or 8 hours a day, and I was not quite one of those people. So I decided to pursue more the math and sciences end of things. But ever since then, I've always been in an orchestra, sometimes two, and so I've kept up the violin.
Well, I really personally enjoyed your great courses on the correlations between math and music. Could you describe some of those basic correlations that perhaps most people miss? I mean, we know the rhythmic correlations between the values of whole notes and half notes and that type of thing, but there's so much deeper. Would you describe those?
Sure. I think that people are really surprised. I think you're right that they see rhythm. That's where they see fractions explicitly, and they think that that's the big connection. And to me, that's not the most important connection. The important connection to me is sort of, it has to be in your brain. It has to be the fact that both math and music are based on patterns. And my favorite piece of evidence about that is just the fact that you see child prodigies in only a few different subjects. You know, you never see an electrical engineering prodigy, somebody who at age 5 is doing great things in electrical engineering. And there's just too much background there. You see them in mathematics, you see them in music, and you see them in chess. And the aspect of those three that, to me, connects them is that you can do a whole lot in all three fields, in math, music, and chess, just with patterns. And this idea of patterns being sort of the root connection between mathematics and music, I think, is a really powerful one. Now, of course, the connections are a lot more than just that. And what I love to say is that the entire musical experience has a mathematical component. So when you start, you know, the musical experience starts with some vibrating object, whether it's vocal cords or an instrument or something like that, and that has a mathematical component. And then you can understand the overtones of that note. You can put notes together so that the overtones sound good with either chords or scales. And then you can start composing music based on those. And some compositions have a very mathematical flavor, including Bach, which has, he did some things that we would now call group theory. We would do things that mathematically weren't discovered until years later. And you go through compositions. And finally, this is probably my favorite, is just that the delivery of music in this day and age, which is almost always digital now, has a lot of mathematics backing up under that. So at every stage of the musical experience, there's mathematics hiding there.
How do you think understanding all these correlations would help a student musician?
There are little ways in which it helps. Any musician who doesn't know that, say, a keyboard is always out of tune isn't going to be as good as a musician who understands that. When you play a chord, you know, if you're playing in an orchestra and the brass section has a chord, they're constantly adjusting that to tune it so that it sounds really good. And in fact, a good brass chorale will tune a chord so that it sounds much better than it does on a modern piano. An equal-tempered piano is always out of key a little bit. It mathematically has to be that way. And so there are ways like that in which understanding the mathematics makes you listen a little bit more closely and be a better musician. But in general, you know, I'm a professor at a liberal arts college, and I think that every subject should enhance everything else. So I think that you're a better musician if you understand the history behind things. You're a better musician if you understand the physics behind your instrument. And you're a better musician if you understand the mathematics that underlies a lot of the music you're playing.
How do understanding those correlations help the general listener, knowing what you discuss in your course?
I think when you're listening to music, you can listen on a lot of different levels. And certainly there are some levels where I don't think the mathematics helps. There's an emotional experience where you can get lost in music. And I don't particularly think that there's anything mathematical about that. But in many of the other ways that you can understand music, you know, you can sort of be analyzing music. You can look for the patterns. You can, you know, see, you can hear the sonata structure in a piece or something like that. And in many of those ways, a lot of that analysis of music, which helps you understand pieces better, a lot of that has a mathematical component.
When you lecture about this, you go around and lecture about this, I understand. What points seem to amaze people, surprise people, or even just resonate the most?
I love talking about auditory illusions. And there's interesting math there and interesting connections to music. And so, you know, one of the more famous auditory illusions is called the missing fundamental. So if you look at all the overtones of a note, and so if a note is vibrating at 100 hertz, then it's also vibrating at 200, 300, 400, 500, all the way on up. And if you take off the bottom one, or even the bottom two or three, and play the note for somebody, they'll still think that the 100 hertz note is there, that the low bass note is there. And it's just a trick of the brain. You know, if your brain is used to hearing all of those frequencies together and you just take one out, then it sort of fills in the gap and it says, oh, there's something wrong. You must really be hearing a 100 hertz note. And the fact that you're hearing that every time you pick up a phone and listen to a man's voice, that's just sort of amazing. Like, the only reason you know it's a guy's, the deep voice of a guy, is that your brain is like filling in the gaps. It's doing some sort of mathematical work to see a pattern, see that it differs a little bit from the pattern it's used to, and it fills in that pattern, and it says it's a guy's voice.
Because the speaker doesn't go down to those frequencies, your brain is filling in those lower ones.
In fact, you know, depending on how you're listening to me right now, how people are listening to this interview right now, they might not be able to actually perceive the 100 hertz note that my nice low voice would be, but their brain still tells them it's there because of this lovely trick. And the fact that, you know, other auditory illusions are actually contained in music is a wonderful thing. My favorite example of this is the opening of Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony, the last movement, where nobody actually plays the melody, but the first and second violins alternate and the melody comes out of that. It's an auditory illusion that wasn't identified until 1972, but Tchaikovsky wrote it into his music in the late 1800s.
So those are some of the things that stand out in terms of like what really resonate with people and surprise people. Anything else fundamental about what you're doing with these lectures and with this course that you'd like to share?
I think people are always coming up with new things that are just amazing. And one of these things that that I learned about after I taped the courses, so it's not in there, has to do with Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. So if you go back a ways, you can try to understand how chords are related. And so you could take all of the major and minor chords, all the three-note chords, and you get 24 of them. And then you could ask, how are those things related? And so you could relate two chords. You could, for instance, write two chords, just think of them as dots, and then connect two of these dots, two of these chords, if the two chords share two of the three notes. And so like a C major chord and a C minor chord would be connected because they share two of those three notes. And if you do that and you try to sort of connect these dots and work around and figure out how you're going to connect all 24 dots, what you find out is that they don't connect if you put those dots on a piece of paper. The only way to connect all 24 appropriately is to put them on a torus, on the surface of a donut. Hmm. And if you do that, then you all of a sudden have this new way of looking at chords. So let's go back to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. There's a section in the third movement where Beethoven plays these chords in order, and they plays them in a particular order. And if you're listening, you can just sort of hear this progression. And if you think of it musically, you can sort of understand what's going on. He does a lot of transferring from major to minor chords, sometimes going from the C major to the C minor, for instance, and sometimes doing other transformations. But you don't really get this until you look at it on the torus. And so what he's doing is he's walking around the chords on a torus in a very regular, very patterned manner. And when you see this, and I show this to audiences now, and if you just look at the music, you would never see it. But if you look at it on a torus, then all of a sudden you see this beautiful pattern. You see exactly what Beethoven is doing.
So there's another connection between the musical and, I guess more specifically, the geometric.
Exactly. And I'm not claiming that Beethoven was thinking about this on the torus. Certainly not. but it's a way of understanding the music that really helps you understand what's going on in terms of the music theory and gives you a really fascinating connection to mathematics.
Well, this has been utterly fascinating. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
It's great to talk with you as well.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Remember, you can follow this show on Twitter at MusicForLifePCG for special links and announcements. Today we have been discussing the inspiring connections between the universe, mathematics, and music. This concept, the harmony of the spheres, has been a recurring theme throughout history, throughout different faiths and creeds even, used in literature and, of course, in music. We have talked about the mathematical fundamentals associated with tuning an instrument and how that inspired certain compositions. And we have talked about how mathematical concepts are taught in the form of music education. And of course, we have seen how the universe has often been a muse for various composers throughout history. For dessert today, where we play an example from the popular or folk tradition or some lighter fare to end the program, let's hear a piece that was inspired by someone's meditations while looking into the night sky. This is a poem my wife, Paula Malone, wrote. She's on the voice faculty here. It was recorded by one of her students, Sarah Pravatsky, and as the composer, I was trying to evoke a musical sound that would blend with this universe theme in this piece. So I took the melody of Twinkle Twinkle Little Star and I modified it by one note, and then I disguised it a little bit more based on how the tune passed through this small orchestra. So here you have it, some dessert about all those stars. This is Father of Lights.
Tonight. their splendor declares your kingdom power and glory, and the hope awaiting me there. This is your realm, dazzling white, to order, sustain, and command, knowing each one by name.
You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.